I see a lot of yous been taking advantage of the fantastic aquatic sales this month. Good for yous, but there's more.
Can I please tell them this week's sale item, Tank?
Calm down, Lenny. I don't want you to sprain a gill. Go clean something.
Yeah, Lenny. What Tank said?
As you know, every Friday we put new aquatic items on sale for 1 week only. Today through January 22nd, yous can save on all aquarium heaters, pumps, plant food, and accessories.
Is it my turn to tell? And we also have a buy one, get one on our live plans. Please, Tank. Like Tank said, today through the 22nd, we're having a sale on water heaters, pumps, plant food, and accessories. It's part of our January aquatics event at all three stores.
Come see us this month for super savings on all things aquatic. One Stop Country Pet Supply, Brattleboro, and Barrie, Vermont. And in the center at Colony Mill, Keene, New Hampshire. Open every day.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Condi. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little chilly out there today, but nice day. Thanks for spending part of it with us. The best news that we're hearing this week. Tomorrow, the halfway point here of winter. Yeehaw. Coming up on the program today, in our later this hour, we're going to chat with some folks that are involved in mentoring here in Vermont. We're going to meet a successful mentee in the process, too. So hope you stick around for that. We'll take your phone calls throughout this morning at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. We'll also get a review of the President's State of the Union speech last night with our White House crew to begin hour number two. And again, we'd love to hear from you. Your phone call is a great part of the program. You can join us at 244-1777. And toll-free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. If you're going to get yelled at by your boss, if you call us here on the program, you're welcome to send me an email as well, too. You can send that to my Green Mountain Access account, mark@gmavt.net. I do try to not just get totally sucked into the technology and actually listen to the guest that we have on the program, so I don't check that too often. But if it's the only way you can reach us, that's the way we would suggest. We're going to begin this morning and talk about this tragic case of two U.S. Olympic skiing hopefuls that were killed in Austria in the beginning of January. And what a treat, what a great honor it is this morning that we bring Nate Vinton to the program. Nate is a staff writer for the New York Daily News. I think it might be one of maybe two jobs out there that would be as good as the job that I have. And he's also written a number of books. We're actually going to have Nate back on the program in a couple of weeks, where we're going to talk about his newest book, The Fall Line: How American Ski Racers Conquered a Sport on the Edge. But this morning we're going to talk about his piece that appeared in the Daily News that talks about the death of these two Olympic skiing hopefuls. Nate, thank you very much for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm great, and it's my pleasure to be with you.
How long have you been writing for the Daily News?
About 2007. I started in December 2007 when the Mitchell Report on steroids and baseball came out. That was my big break.
Yeah, okay, because you've written a book about steroids and baseball.
That's right. Yeah.
So what do you think about, before we get to skiing here, so what do you think about guys like Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens getting into the Hall of Fame?
Well, you know, I don't have strong opinions about that. I'm not one of the baseball writers that is a gatekeeper on the Hall of Fame. And, I'm not a voter on that. A lot of my colleagues are. I'm actually pretty happy I'm not in that position. But I think it's sad. I think it's too bad that some great players are not getting in there. But I understand that they want to maintain a certain standard. But I think they have a lot of trouble defending those standards when push comes to shove. There's no question that Roger Clemens is one of the greatest pitchers in history, and maybe he will get in someday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about your piece that appeared in the Daily News, Anatomy of a Slide, How a Deadly Austrian Avalanche Trapped U.S. Olympic Skiing Hopefuls Ronnie Burlak and Bryce Astle. Who were Ronnie Burlak and Bryce Astle?
Well, they were members of the U.S. ski team's development team. They were young. Astle was 19 and Burlak was 20. And they were on a trip with a few other young prospects. The men's team, they were in Austria. Ronnie Burlak came originally from New Hampshire, but he had gone to Burke Mountain School up in East Burke, Vermont, and that's a sort of reliable outlet of top ski racers. And Bryce Astle came from Little Cottonwood Canyon in Utah. He skied at Alta and Snowbird, and actually he was on the same ski team that I was on when I was growing up, incidentally, and he had just been invited along. This was his very first trip to Europe.
Wow.
And they went over to Solden, Austria.
How were you on the same team as him?
Well, growing up, I was a ski racer, and I, you know, we didn't cross over. I was a coach there after college, and even then, he was too young to come into my orbit, but we had friends in common, and some of my old friends were his coaches. So, so this story kind of hit close to home when I had to write it.
Mm-hmm. You lived at one time in Waitsfield?
I did, yeah. My first job in journalism in 2003 was writing for Ski Racing Magazine, actually 2002, and I lived in Waitsfield, Vermont when Ski Racing Magazine was based there, and then the magazine moved to Colorado and I followed it there.
When you say these two guys were prospects, what does that mean?
Well, they'd been identified as some of the top racers in their age group, and it's at an age group where it becomes important to take the American racers at that level and put them into European competition where the courses are harder and the fields are deeper. There's just a lot more Austrian, Swiss, French racers over there racing on very competitive courses, and so the U.S. ski team identifies some young talent, tries to get them over into that scene, if you will, as soon as they can, and that's what the U.S. team was doing. So they had been identified, they were getting some funding and support from the team, but they were not yet ready for the World Cup Tour, which is, you know, the big leagues of alpine ski racing.
Mm-hmm. So they're just kind of being brought along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very competitive and kind of merciless. It's an age group where, you know, you get an injury and the window closes for you, and a lot of athletes of that age are prepared to go to college, maybe race in college, but they're trying to give professional skiing one last shot.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever come close to going pro?
No, I was never at the level that these guys were. My little brother was, but I was never quite that good. But I do remember being that age and just skiing being everything for me. That's what I sympathize with some of these racers. It's just, these kids were, I don't want to call them kids, but these young men were extremely devoted to skiing.
Well, it's such a rush, right? I mean, it's like the ultimate dopamine rush.
I think it is. I think alpine ski racing activates a fight or flight response in people. I think you get such a rush of adrenaline when you're so close to potential disaster and also able to harness amazing amounts of the Earth's natural forces, the gravity and the centrifugal forces, and even just the wind. It's a really unique experience to ski as fast as these people do. And I think they're all a little bit addicted to the adrenaline.
Describe where they were and describe the landscape of where they were.
Sure. Okay. Well, I've actually been there a good number of times. They were in an area called, they were at Solden, Austria. It's a ski resort at the head of the Ustal Valley, which is a long, very, very dramatic, beautiful valley in western Austria, right in Tyrol. There's glaciers on the top of the peaks, and down in the valley where they were staying, there, you know, there's a rushing stream, and it can be warm and nice down there, and you have a long road up to the mountain, and chairlifts, obviously. The glaciers up there, every year, the Rettenbach Glacier hosts a World Cup ski race that is the season opener, because they can ski on it in October. And it's become a real mecca for ski racers because there's good training there as early as September, and the ski racers can get up there and train. So where they actually were on the day that they were killed was, they were in a valley that's carved out by the glacier. The glacier has retreated up the valley, so you have this U-shaped, mostly treeless expanse that looks like something out of, the Lord of the Rings movies. It's very dramatic, beautiful landscape.
Hmm. Wow. You know, one of the things that we're talking with Nate Vinton, he's a writer for the Daily News and wrote about the tragic avalanche that killed a couple of U.S. skiing hopefuls. You know, I was interested in reading your piece. You talked about how European ski resorts as opposed to American ski resorts and this whole threat of avalanche. Can you talk about the difference in how those two treat that potential disaster?
Yeah, with some exceptions, the European resorts are just a little bit less regulated. The ski industry kind of grew up more organically there than it did here. A lot of the towns that were hosting, that have ski resorts in them, were maybe spa towns because they have hot springs or something like that, and then skiing came along gradually. In the U.S., most of our ski industry was sort of grafted onto mountains after World War II in most cases, and so you have more of they've preserved more of the nature experience, if you will. In Europe, the boundaries of the resort are typically a little less defined, and what's within those boundaries is less controlled. There's less cutting of trees and patrolling of the mountain to make sure that there's no hazards. You're left a little bit to your own devices in Europe, and they do prepare pistes, they call them. And if you decide to go off piste, a piste is basically a prepared run. If you decide to go off piste, it's known, and it should be known that you're taking your own risks and need to be prepared.
And that's what happened here.
Yes, they went off piste. They were on a cat track, and it's very clear what they did. It wasn't a wild and crazy pitch, but it was sort of a shortcut in a way. They were going to follow a cat track, which is just a road that's covered with snow, and they were going to follow it on some switchbacks. And it's really just two long switchbacks. It goes all the way into the valley and then cuts back. And so you could, if you just cut off the difference, you'd have a nice steep pitch there. And that's where it went.
Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
Well, the exact sequence of events is, the word isn't disputed because it's just everybody saw something differently, but there were six athletes, five Americans and one British skier, and they started out down this slope, and in a a pretty big avalanche broke away and swept them down this mountainside. It's very steep. It's about 1,500 meters, we estimated, just by looking at talking to the mountain managers. They slid over some rocks. A few of the athletes were able to sort of swim out of it.
Wow.
And the others were wrapped up in it as it went over the rocks and buried at the bottom.
So that, I mean, I don't know much about avalanches. That sounds substantial, 1,500 meters.
Sure, yeah. It was a pretty big one. I'm sorry, I should say 1,500 feet. It was, I had that wrong there, but I'm just looking at my story right now. But the slope is, you know, it's deceptive looking at it. It's pretty steep, and it sort of steepens at the bottom, and there's some rocks there and a sort of chute, and that was what they were aiming for, but the avalanche took them right over that.
And there were people that were able to get out that were trapped?
I don't know how trapped they were. They were in it. They were sliding and were able to arrest their fall. And there were some others that were just standing nearby. And there were some other skiers, not with the group, that saw it happen, that helped with the rescue attempt. And actually, a lot of people convened on the scene right away from everyone that I spoke to about it. There was a pretty good-sized rescue party immediately. And
right, yeah. I mean,
teammates of the skiers that were buried were right there with the rescuers helping with the search.
The image that you paint of people poking in the ground with their skis and these avalanche poles was, you know, you could just really sort of almost feel the, I don't want to use the word panic, but boy, it was pretty close to it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's terrifying. And, you know, I've seen avalanches before. Luckily, I've never been caught in one, but it's just an immense natural force that is unleashed. And, you know, it's like being in a river. You very quickly understand how little power you have to direct your own fall, your own experience. It's a very powerful force.
It's sort of, I'm feeling like it's like being in a washing machine, body surfing, and in a whiteout on the interstate all at the same time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who've been in avalanches talk about not knowing, you don't know what's up and what's down. And you may, you know, a lot of times people will be buried, but they won't be very deep. You hear a lot of cases where there's an avalanche and someone is buried and they're only a few inches under the snow. It's one of the reasons that the ski patrol have dogs with them, because they can send dogs right out onto the pile of snow and sniff people out.
You mentioned in your piece that there were a bunch of rumors that came out afterward that really bothered you, and I guess I'm wondering, A, what those might have been, but in this whole question about whether or not you know, this was of their own doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think I said in the piece that it bothered me, because I understand, I'm very sympathetic with my colleagues in EF who are struggling to get information as quick as they can from a, particularly from a, you know, a situation where people are grieving and confused and don't want to talk. But there were some rumors that spread fast. Ski racing is a very small community, and there were some rumors that spread, but luckily my editor gave me a little bit of time to really dig into what happened and speak with people from the scene, and it was just very sad. People are really shocked.
But was this a case of them using really bad judgment or not?
Well, I wouldn't say really judgment. I mean, you're always taking risks when you go skiing. And you know, these were young men who were ambitious in their skiing. And, you know, it's self-evident that that was not a safe slope to be on at that time. But, you know, that might not have been totally obvious. I think this could have really happened to anyone. I think these aren't skiers that are prone to, these aren't the kind of skiers that are prone to going out on the mountain and being very conservative. They go out there actually and push themselves to their limits every single day.
Mm-hmm.
That's necessary. And at the same time, you know, this slope was, you know, it was not, it was not a, these were not great conditions. So, you know, I'd hate to question their judgment because these are also great skiers, and they misjudged it, but they are far more literate in reading a mountain than most people are, and so, you know, they missed this one, but I think they have good judgment about what they can ski typically.
Let's go to Moncton. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Mark, and good morning to your guest. Having had the opportunity to ski over in Austria a couple of times, I know that when my wife and I were taken out onto some slopes, we were made to wear some avalanche beacons that can both work as transmitters and receivers. I'm going to assume, and I guess my question is, did any of these people, any of these skiers, have the beacons with them, or were they out without them?
Yeah, that's a good question. They did not. They did not have avalanche beacons or shovels or probes or the thing you need to have if you're going into an avalanche zone. You know, it's not entirely clear if their goal on this day was just to be going and doing off-piste skiing or if this was just something they saw an opportunity to take this one, this one run and risked it. They weren't prepared for off-piste skiing, but had they had avalanche beacons with them, which are, you know, small transponder units that, you know, go in a harness on your chest or something, they can also be built into your coat. Had they had those, would they have been able to save them? Maybe, maybe not. The avalanche was buried them pretty deeply and also carried them over some rocks that really battered them on their way down.
Was this just a tragic accident, nothing to learn from this, or any lessons learned here?
Oh, yeah, I think there's definitely some lessons learned. No question about, you know, the dangers of off-piste skiing, even within the confines of a resort. I think it's possible that the U.S. ski team will consider building avalanche transponders into their uniforms. I know that they're going to, I've talked to some coaches that have talked about wanting to do that. Maybe more education for some of the younger skiers that are in Europe for the first time. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, by and large, those are the lessons and there's not that much more to say about that.
Mm-hmm. And this was, I know for one of them, it was his first time there, but for both of them, it was his first time skiing in Austria?
You know, I can't answer that. I know Bryce asked who it was. I'm not sure about Ronnie Berlach. He came from a ski racing family, and I'm going to guess that he had been over there before, but Bryce Astle, this was his very first trip, and, you know, speaking with his coach, his main coach at the snowbird ski team, who was my old coach, he was telling me, this is Steve Benoist, he was telling me that Bryce was just over the moon with excitement about going to ski in Europe and going to ski in Austria with the U.S. ski team. It was a huge opportunity for him, and he'd only been there a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. As you know, this station's owned by Ken Squire, who's very heavily involved in motorsports. And one of the things that's always struck me, and we've talked about it before, I've spoken with him about it, is how quickly the racing community, after a fatal accident, they mourn the person that's lost, but they really have this move on approach because you got to live for another day and it's an inherently unsafe sport. What was the reaction within the, was the reaction anything close to that in the skiing community?
Yeah, it was. I mean, the season goes on and the racing goes on and this kind of thing does occasionally happen. And, you know, ski racing has an incredibly high injury rate. People are having, you know, maybe not being killed very often, but really terrible injuries sometimes, to the point where a major knee dislocation is, I don't want to say routine, but yeah. that happens all the time. And then, you know, every season, people break their necks or their backs or something like that and get knocked unconscious. And so ski racing already has a sort of ski racers already have a sort of way of blocking out these really terrible ideas, because it can be paralyzing for a ski racer, so to speak, to have their, you know, can really damage their confidence to a point where they can't ski anymore if they linger on these things too much. I do know that the U.S. ski team really sort of circled the wagons, and the athletes came together and mourned in their own way. And they had a visit from the U.S. ambassador, came right to the scene where it happened, and that I thought was a pretty powerful statement.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you for your time this morning, and I look forward to our next discussion. We'll next talk about your book, The Fall Line, How American Ski Racers Conquered a Sport on the Edge. And though the book is not officially out, it is available on Amazon, you told me.
That's right. It's available on Amazon and in bookstores starting February 2nd, but some people who have ordered it on Amazon have actually already had it delivered, so but I'm looking forward to that conversation. That'll be fun.
Thank you for your time this morning. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Nate Vinton is a staff writer for the Daily News and put together a piece on the death of those two U.S. skiing prospects, Anatomy of a Slide. You can find it on at nydailynews.com, and you can find it on that website. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the importance of mentoring. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
Warm up to a Honda during the winter sales event.